from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Right behind the gun issue raised so terribly in the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School comes the issue of mental health. We don't fully understand yet the story of 20-year-old Adam Lanza in Newtown. But at Virginia Tech, in Tucson, with Jared Loughner, in the Aurora, Colorado killings and more, we know. And the calls are going up for more to be done. This hour On Point, mental health and our drumbeat of mass killings. You can join the conversation. Can these tragedies be foretold, stopped? Is mental health care the key? What do we need here? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You can hear this question, this theme of mental health coming in lots of commentary that's come after the terrible massacre in Newtown. Yesterday, MSNBC's Joe Scarborough, host of Morning Joe, former Republican congressman from Florida, said the reasons behind the shooting at Sandy Hook are many and complicated.
The violence we see spreading from shopping malls in Oregon to movie theaters in Colorado to college campuses in Virginia to elementary schools in Connecticut. It's being spawned by the toxic brew of a violent popular culture, a growing mental health crisis, and the proliferation of combat-styled weapons.
Guns, culture, and a mental health crisis, says Joe Scarborough. Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy said there were many issues that need to be addressed, guns not least, but mental health came up in his observation as well.
I think that there's certain problems that we have in our society that have to be addressed. We don't treat the mentally ill well. We don't reach out to families that are in trouble particularly well. We allow the assault weapons ban to lapse. There are lots of issues that need to be taken on as a society and have a reasonable discussion about how we help families in trouble, how we make progress in treating folks, how we intervene.
We'll hear in this hour from Connecticut's Commissioner for Mental Health and from the father of a troubled son who says our mental health system is failing us. Joining me first today from Bethesda, Maryland is Dr. E. Fuller Torrey, psychiatrist, prominent researcher in schizophrenia. He's executive director of the Stanley Medical Research Institute and founder of the Treatment Advocacy Center, a nonprofit aimed at promoting treatment of severe mental illness. He's author of The Insanity Offense, How America's Failure to Treat the Seriously Mentally Ill Endangers Its Citizens, and The Invisible Plague. Dr. Torrey, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
Now, we don't know exactly what's up with Adam Lanza, but you've been writing and talking about this for some time now. What do you see in the picture that we're all staring at in horror this week that stretches well beyond Newtown, Connecticut?
Well, first of all, what I see, Tom, is I see something that is clearly increasing in incidence. We're seeing more and more of these mass killings, and about half of them, or I'd say at least half of them, are involved with severe mental illness in one form or another on it. We obviously don't know a final diagnosis on Adam Lanza yet. He clearly fits somewhere into an autism spectrum. Most individuals with autism are not violent, but a few do become violent and need to be on medication. I suspect he's going to fall into that category and may have been preventable if he had been properly treated.
But how, you know, we've got to be so careful here because we have people, we all have our issues, right? And we've got people in all shades of mental health and its opposite. It's so easy to stigmatize. These are our fellow citizens. We don't want to paint them as mass murderers writ large.
You're absolutely right. But on the other hand, if a small group of them, and the evidence is very strong that a small group of them do become violent, if they're not treated, and I would emphasize if they're not treated, if we don't pay attention to this, the stigma ends up much greater. The people who are suffering most, in addition to the families, obviously, are people with mental illness who are stigmatized because of the behavior of people who are apparently mentally ill. As you mentioned, the James Holmes, Jared Loughner, etc., there's nothing that causes stigma more for people with mental illness than to have someone who is mentally ill out there shooting up a classroom or a college.
I'm reading here Dr. Richard Friedman, MD, citing a National Institute of Mental Health study that followed 18,000 people and found that the lifetime prevalence of violence among people with serious mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, was 16% compared with 7% among people with no mental disorder. That doesn't sound like an enormous difference to me, Dr. Torrey.
Well, it's not an enormous difference, and most people with severe mental illnesses never become violent. And if they're being treated, the evidence is very strong that they're not more violent than their general population. It is a small group, about 1% of people with severe mental illnesses who are not being treated, who are dangerous, who do become violent. They cause about 10% of the homicides in the United States, and they're the ones who end up in jails and prisons and homeless and are causing most of the problems, mostly because they're not being treated.
So let's look systemically here. We're looking on the gun side, and we're not going to ignore that, but today we're looking here. Is this something that could be addressed? Are we failing somehow to address this?
Well, the gun issue is obviously important, and it's inexplicable why we allow the kinds of guns out there that can do what they can do. But on the other hand, in other countries, you have problems like this where guns are not available. For example, in China, where mentally ill people going into primary schools use knives. So getting rid of guns by themselves is not going to solve the problem. It'll help, but it won't solve the problem.
So that's the gun side. What about on the mental health side? Are we somehow failing to systemically look at the needs of our fellow citizens who have issues?
We are failing miserably to treat the most seriously mentally ill. We do a pretty good job of treating people who are less seriously mentally ill. But the very seriously mentally ill, especially those with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, who don't know that they're sick and therefore won't seek treatment, these are the ones that we're failing, and these are the ones who end up causing problems if they're not treated.
I mean, how do you really do that? It's a great big country. There are a lot of people here. Mental health issues are hardly rare. Can you really put a net out that catches those who need help, across the board?
We cannot identify everyone who needs help, but most people who commit violent acts have a previous history of violent acts. They have a diagnosis of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, and most importantly, they're not being treated, and often they're also substance abusers. So it's for example, the Jared Loughner who killed the people in Tucson, Arizona,
yeah.
He was clearly identified as severely mentally ill, and the state failed him because the state had withdrawn money from the program that would have treated him. That was a completely preventable incident.
But here, I'm looking at another researcher here, Dr. Michael Stone at Columbia, a clinical psychiatrist, expert on mass murders, quoted here in the Times saying most of these killers, looking at mass murder, most of these killers are young men who are not floridly psychotic. They tend to be paranoid loners who hold a grudge and are full of rage. But if they're not floridly psychotic, how do you spot them? How do you know?
Well, take Jared Loughner, for example. It was quite clear that he was very disturbed. He should have been at least evaluated. No, you can't predict, obviously, in every instance, and you're going to miss some of them. And as I mentioned, only about half of these mass killings are being committed by people with severe mental illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that if you treat people, you're going to make all this go away altogether, but you're going to reduce it markedly.
So what would a better systemic address of this problem look like?
A better systemic address would look like the possibility of putting somebody into a evaluation. For example, Jared Loughner, given his behavior in the classroom and on the college campus in Tucson, should have been evaluated psychiatrically, should have been offered treatment, and if they thought he was dangerous, should have been mandated to treatment. We've been very reluctant to do this because we, I think, properly observe people's civil rights. But in some cases, if people don't know they're sick, they need to be treated whether they think they need treatment or not.
We don't know yet in Adam Lanza's case what exactly was going on. But, you know, from what we do know, is this a situation where there could have been intervention if there weren't clear signs, if there wasn't a trail of, and I don't know if there was, of medical record here?
We don't know. We don't know precisely the diagnosis, although it clearly falls into an autism spectrum on it. We don't know how much he was treated. He clearly was on medication at some point. We don't know whether he was taking medication at the time. I strongly suspect he was not on it. But we do know that young men who develop severe psychiatric disorders in their late teens and early 20s, a small number, if they are not treated, do become dangerous. We don't have enough facts in terms of Adam Lanza to be able to recreate what happened or what didn't happen, but it's quite possible that he could have been prevented if he had been properly treated.
Is anybody who commits mass murder sort of by definition in that act mentally ill, Dr. Torrey, or not?
No, there's about half the mass murders, I'd say, where there's no evidence of severe mental illness on it. I mean, you can argue and say anybody who does something like this is crazy, but that's kind of that's not accurate, because some of these people are quite rational when they kill other people.
And so here we are. What's your call for more funds, for a change in law?
A change in law would help a great deal, and the Treatment Advocacy Center, which I work with, has tried to change laws. Connecticut, ironically, has among the poorest laws for involuntarily treating people who need to be treated, and I would guess that if Adam Lanza's mother had tried to get involuntary treatment for him, she would have found it very difficult because of the way the laws in Connecticut are written.
We're going to hear from the commissioner for the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services in Connecticut, Patricia Reamer, who strongly defends her state's approach to dealing with mental health. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about mental health and the drumbeat of mass killings in this country, Virginia Tech, Tucson, Aurora, Colorado, and now maybe Newtown, Connecticut. What we're missing and why? Yesterday, speaking with ABC News, Utah Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz said mental health is an issue that needs to be on the table in the conversations all over the country these days.
We have to deal with the mental health aspect. I think it's fair game. I think we absolutely should talk about the intersection of a lethal weapon and it relates to mental health.
Yesterday, Liza Long, the mother and author of the viral blog post, I Am Adam Lanza's Mother, told NBC News she has fears as the mother of a teenager with mental health issues.
I'm the mother of a mentally ill son. He's 13 years old. He's bright. He loves Harry Potter. Loves his snuggle animals. He's working on a novel. But when he gets angry, he frightens me. I first learned about the Connecticut school shooting at work. I closed the door to my office and started to shiver. Every time I hear about a mass shooting, I think about my son. And I wonder if someday I'll be that mom.
Liza Long has been since criticized for her blog post, namely for her own use of violent language directed at her children. It's a minefield, but people are thinking about it and talking about it. Dr. E. Fuller Torrey joins us today, author of The Insanity Defense and the Invisible Plague, expert in schizophrenia. With us right now from Washington is Pete Early, author, mental health advocate, and father of a son with mental health issues. His latest op-ed in USA Today is headlined, Dealing with Guns and Mental Illness. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Pete Early, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
We read your piece in USA Today, Pete, and see you looking to tread this fine line between stigmatizing, which is so easy, so terribly easy to do. And on the other hand, you write, we need to ask why our mental health system is failing us. How do you look at this moment, Pete, and what's going on?
Well, I see it as a very teachable moment because the country's attention has finally turned to mental health. And that is very, very important. You know, I have a son with mental illness. He feels terrible about what happened at Sandy Hook, but he also says, don't smear me. Don't make me one of those people. At the same time, my son has been arrested. My son has been violent. And the problem is trying to say, look, people with mental illness are much likely to be victims. They, by their nature, are not dangerous. And yet, when you're dealing with someone who's not thinking clearly, there's always that possibility, and that's frightening.
You're writing here, you remind us of a big study that found the vast majority of violent acts in America are not attributable to mental illness. And you point out, as you just say, that, I mean, the irony here is people with mental illness are more likely to be victims than perpetrators. Let's keep that in mind. So where's the right balance, Pete?
I also point out in that, Tom, if I may mention it, that the gun controls that are in effect now have shown little impact in stopping people with mental illness from harming themselves. That is the real danger, which is these people turning guns on themselves is much more likely than turning it on someone else. Part of the problem is, you know, people say, what's wrong with our mental health system? Well, just about everything is. I've spent the last 6 years, I've traveled to every state except for three of them, and what you find is a badly fractured state. I live in Fairfax County, Virginia, one of the wealthiest in the United States, and yet when I did my research, there was a two-week wait if you had a mental illness, a two-week wait to get into a treatment program, six-month wait to see a case manager, and an 18-year wait to get into any kind of housing to help you if you had a mental illness. That's what we're dealing with. Virginia, the IG recently reported that 70 people who meet the dangerousness criteria are turned out on the streets by hospitals because there are no hospital beds available. And this is rampant across the United States. So as a parent, when you're confronted with someone, you know, look, I wrote a book about this. I live in a wealthy county. Mm-hmm. I have connections at the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. The last time my son had a mental break, I couldn't get him help. He ended up getting tasered by the police and taken off and hogtied. Now, if I couldn't get him help,
in based your on, position, yeah.
Yeah. What chance do you think someone, maybe a mother who doesn't know the system, even if they're educated, it's very difficult to get access to mental health services?
Ifuller Tori, Pete Early, please stand by. Aaron is calling from Boston. Boston, Aaron, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think that for me, the issue kind of is it actually an extension of our healthcare system in general. I mean, the fact that we don't have universal coverage, the kind of which would provide everybody access to both. To both general hospital care as well as mental health services, should they need them from an early age onwards, is part of the problem. And we're seeing the manifestation of those, you know, of those problems now, where the services provided are so fragmented and so uneven that, I mean, we can't legislate this at the state level anymore. And I'm very concerned that the discussion is being hijacked politically so that no further action needs to be taken on either mental health or gun control.
We'll try and avoid that trap, Aaron, but I'm glad you raised the issue. I mean, Ifuller Tori, what about it? Is this a coverage problem, a health insurance coverage problem, or is it a services delivery and awareness problem, if those are two different streams?
Tom, it's all of the above, and Aaron's absolutely right. The failure of our national system for treating people with severe mental illnesses is part of our failure of our general health system. And in fact, if you are going to become severely mentally ill in the near future, I would suggest any of the northern European countries where you're going to be better off. And the reason is that they have national health insurance there and everybody is covered.
Tom,
yes,
can
Pete.
I jump in there though? Because mental health is different. And here's why it's different.
Mm-hmm.
My son didn't think he was sick. He was psychotic. He was talking about suicide, but he was convinced he was not sick. Consequently, I was told when I took him to the hospital, bring your son back after he tries to kill someone or kills you. 2 days later, he was arrested. He broke into a house to take a bubble bath. Luckily, no one was there. And this is what is happening across America. We have changed our mental health system into a criminal justice system. Dr. Fuller Torrey's research shows that there is a higher likelihood of you getting arrested in this country if you have a mental illness than getting into a hospital because we've closed down hospital beds. That's outrageous. 600,000 people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder are in our jails and prisons. The LA jail is the largest mental institution, public institution in our country. That's wrong.
Dr. Fuller Tori is tough on saying, well, some people need to be in institutions or some need forced medication for their treatment. Are you for that, Pete?
You know, it depends on the individual. Look, I've spent time in Washington, D.C. with the homeless. You got one guy who's homeless, who's under a bridge, who has no idea what even day it is. He is so sick. You have another one who has bipolar disorder, who seems perfectly fine until he talks about the Mazers, which are the CIA reading his thoughts. You have a third one who went to Atlantic City. He's homeless because he blew all of his money and every savings gambling during a bipolar manic phase. Does that mean that we're going to take all those people and you know, force medicate them? No, but under the law right now, you can't intervene with any of those people. You have to let that guy under the bridge sit there and suffer because he's not dangerous yet. And that is the gold crown. That is what we look at. And that, if that was your son, would you want that?
I don't know how to judge this. No, you don't paint a picture that sounds too appealing there. This is tough territory. Pete Early, standby in Washington, E. Fuller Torrey in Bethesda, with us right now from Hartford, Connecticut, is Patricia Reamer. She's commissioner for the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services for the state of Connecticut. She's just today returned from Newtown, Connecticut. Patricia Reamer, Commissioner Reamer, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
You've seen how mental health has blown up as an issue in the aftermath of the Newtown shootings, the terrible tragedy, and we're sorry for what your state is facing.
Thank you.
Do you think this is an appropriate response to this and the sort of drumbeat of mass shootings we've seen before Newtown? Does it point to mental health care as somewhere we need to be giving more attention, a different kind of attention, Commissioner?
Well, let me start by saying that the individual that was involved with these shootings, we have no confirmed evidence that he had a mental illness, including the media's attention to his being on the autism spectrum. We are not aware that that is in fact true. And I think one of the difficulties in this kind of horrific situation, and let me tell you, it is almost beyond horrific, is that the immediate turn is to individuals with mental illness and pointing the finger and continuing both the stigmatization and, in my opinion, the discrimination that they experience. I knew that this is where we were going to go, and I'm deeply concerned about that.
We have been careful to point out and reconfirm with you right now exactly what you're saying, that we do not know the story with Adam Lanza at this point.
Right.
And people's attention have turned to our whole culture. They've turned to our gun culture and our gun laws. And with this sequence of things we've seen in Virginia Tech, in Tucson, in Aurora, Colorado, Commissioner, mental health comes up. We are not pinning that on Adam Lanza here in particular. But the country's trying to grapple with this whole challenge. As you say, this is horrific beyond description. It's hard to understand. We're trying to find if there's something here that we should be addressing that we're not. You know mental health. Is there something more or different we should be doing?
I think that, and I can speak primarily to the state of Connecticut, we have a fairly well-funded system. We are very recovery-oriented, as I have not been listening to the show previously. But I
am, you know, Dr. Sure Torrey is for a tougher institutionalization and medication regimen, I would say.
Right, and outpatient commitment. Connecticut does not have outpatient commitment laws at this point.
What does outpatient commitment mean, Pat?
Well, I think that's a very good question, because it means different things for different states, and that's a really important point.
I mean, I don't know what it means at all.
Okay, so I am going to say the easiest way that I can say to explain it is that it usually involves some sort of forced medication, or what I want to point out that varies from state to state, though, is under what circumstances. So is it simply that somebody's not taking the medication, or is it that they have some history of violence or dangerousness? And if you go through state to state, you will see that the laws are highly varied, and the research in terms of the outcomes of that, I think, is impacted by those variations. In Connecticut, we have lots of diversion efforts when people who commit criminal acts can be offered help if they have mental health illness. We have jail diversion programs in every court in the state. We have mechanisms to evaluate risk and provide greater support, including I heard Dr. Torrey's most recent statements about a homeless person. We have homeless outreach and engagement teams, again, throughout the state who know where people are and know where they need to go to find people and then continue engaging with them and supervising them. But that's obviously when they come to our attention. In terms of the clinical research, I think some of the best research has come out of New York State. And what the conclusion seemed to be was that it was an increased level of support, supervision, and assistance, which led to improvements in functioning, such as decreased hospitalization, arrest, or events of violence. But that level was compliant with individuals who were taking medication in terms of the control group and the research group.
Pat Reamer, there in Hartford, I think it was Pete Early who was talking about the homeless, but E. Fuller Torrey is with us, and he was critical earlier in our conversation of Connecticut's bent when it comes to mental health care. Dr. Torrey, could you put that concern to Pat Reamer? She's with us now from Hartford.
Sure. The issue, Tom, is the people that Pete Early talked about earlier, that about half the people with severe psychiatric disorders have damage to their brain in a way that makes it impossible for them to understand that they're sick. So there's a group of people who will never voluntarily accept treatment because their brain tells them there's nothing wrong. In this sense, they said it fit into people who have severe Alzheimer's disease, who lose their ability to understand that they're sick. Now, Connecticut does a pretty good job with people who voluntarily seek treatment. They do a bad job of those people who don't know they're sick and need treatment. The commitment laws in Connecticut are among the worst in the United States in the sense that it's very difficult to get somebody into treatment if they need treatment and don't need treatment. And as Ms. Reamer said, Connecticut is one of only six states in the United States that does not have a provision for assisted outpatient treatment, or as we call it, AOT, which has indeed been shown to decrease episodes of violence.
And that's required medication for those not in a hospitalized setting.
That's correct. These are people who have proven dangerousness, who you say you can live in the community as long as you take your medication, but it is a condition of living in the community that you must take your medication.
Pat Reamer, do you expect more pressure for that kind of treatment on this side of the terrible event in Newtown?
I think that it's very early to know that. As you know, there's lots of conversations across the nation going on, as you said earlier, about both gun control and treatment for individuals with mental illness. I feel that we do have in place adequate statutes for individuals that can require cooperation with psychiatric treatment as a condition of release or parole. We have one of the only psychiatric security review boards. There's only very few of them in the nation for individuals who have committed crimes and are found not guilty by reason of insanity. That board works with us but is extremely careful and cautious about the level of care that individuals who have demonstrated criminal or violent behavior need to comply with. And the other thing I would say is that we have a very, very strong advocacy community in the state who works with us to ensure that we are very, very cognizant of individuals' civil rights and the issues that we need to be cognizant of as we treat a population who has a mental illness, which is no different from a physical illness.
Patricia Reamer, Commissioner for the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services for the state of Connecticut, our hearts are with you and everybody in Connecticut. Thank you for being with us for a few minutes today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about mental health and the drumbeat of mass killings we've seen in this country. Virginia Tech, Tucson, Aurora, Colorado, and now still waiting to see about Newtown, Connecticut. There are many issues raised here. Issues about gun control. We'll talk about that again tomorrow, the power of the NRA. Issues of our entire culture and very specific issues to this case. But in there, among all those, the question of mental health emerges as well. Pete Early is with us, author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. His son has had trouble on this front, and he's confronted how difficult it is to get help when it's needed. Dr. E. Fuller Torrey is with us, author of The Insanity Defense and The Invisible Plague, expert in schizophrenia, controversial in some quarters for his tough push for institutionalization and forced medication, if and when that appears to be necessary. You can join the conversation as well, 800-423-TALK. A couple of responses here from the many, many online. Fuller Torrey, Pete Early. Jillian says, while the U.S. has to have a serious discussion about effectively aiding those with mental health disorders and their families, she writes, I'm fearful that we may start demonizing everyone with mental health issues because of a select few with severe and violent mental health disorders. And Brett writes to us, Brett Earle, Dr. Fuller Torrey says, to mandate treatment for the mentally ill before they ever become violent is walking down a very slippery slope toward a serious violation of individual liberties. What do you say to those concerns of stigmatization and individual rights, liberties, Dr. Fuller Torrey?
Well, Tom, certainly the demonizing issue and the stigmatizing issue is a very important one. And the fact that you have this conversation today is a very it's a very important positive step in the right direction. I would argue, however, if we don't address the issue of the severely mentally ill who are responsible for some of these mass killings on it, and again, it's about half of them on it, the people who suffer most are the people who are stigmatized by it, which is the rest of the people who are severely mentally ill. So just kind of pretending it doesn't exist means, and if we don't do anything to stop these in the future, it means they're going to continue, and they appear to be increasing, and there's going to be more and more stigma. So I would argue that if we don't address these issues, we're going to end up having much greater stigma in the long run. The solution is that we've got to figure out how to treat people who need to be treated and cannot fend for themselves on it. In terms of the involuntary treatment, yeah, of course it's a slippery slope. At this point, we're not even close to the slippery slope because it's almost impossible to treat people who need to be treated and don't know that they're sick in this country. We have over 1 million lawyers in this country, and they are in not short supply. They can defend people. We need a judicial process, obviously. Nobody is arguing that I, as a psychiatrist, as I could say 100 years ago, could hospitalize you just because I wanted to. You have to have very strict procedures to hospitalize and, if necessary, treat people who need to be treated. But we can do that. There's ways to do that to protect people's rights at the same time.
How much can we hope to, if everything was working perfectly in your view, how many of these instances could we hope to head off? How many of these people could we hope to find in advance of them doing damage to themselves and others? Is it really possible to do that?
Wait, yes. Can I say something,
Tom? Of course, Pete. Yeah, come on in. Look,
you're focusing on trying to stop an incident. As a parent, I'm focusing on trying to get people who are suffering help. You know what?
Well, I think they're two sides of the same coin in some instances, are they not?
Yeah. But you know, what happened at Sandy Hook is horrific. But we have people dying on the streets right now with mental illnesses, and that's something people don't seem to want to focus on. I want to, if I may, mm-hmm. you know, I want to say something. I was stopped from helping my son because of the dangerousness criteria. And listen, I know how people with mental illness have had their civil rights trampled on. Mm-hmm. But why do we focus on dangerousness, which is impossible to predict? No one can predict if someone's going to be dangerous. Now, states have started recognizing this. They've said gravely disabled and unable to care for self or others. But with all our collective thinking and wisdom, can't we come up with a better standard that will protect people's rights, but also give people who... I saw my son with tinfoil wrapped around his head watching television, and I couldn't do anything about that. That's ridiculous.
We feel that pain. I mean, I don't want to ignore that one bit, but we're having this conversation on this side of a terrible event, where there has been a lot of dangerousness exhibited. And what about this, Dr. Fuller Torrey? Dangerousness is impossible to predict. Is that the case?
No, it's not impossible to predict. There are indications. People have evidence of substance abuse with severe mental illness that's being untreated are more dangerous on it. Your question is to how many of these we could prevent. We could probably prevent about a third of them if we had an adequate mental health system, mental illness treatment system. Well, we could have prevented Virginia Tech. We could have prevented Tucson. I've been looking at these now for the last 30 years, and they're clearly increasing in incidence. But at least in about a third of them, it looks like the severely mentally ill person who committed the acts was identifiable as potentially dangerous, but was not treated.
But Pete Ehrlich wasn't even able to get help when his son was far shy of any problem like this. He was just exhibiting behavior that was, you know, difficult for the whole family, no doubt, and he couldn't even get help at that point.
That's right. Pete is absolutely right that the mental illness treatment system in the United States is totally broken. It's broken in Virginia. It's broken in Connecticut. It's broken now in every one of our states, and it is much worse than it was 30 years ago.
Why is that? Are there more cases, more problems out there, or less help available relatively?
Well, the problem is, Tom, is we simply emptied out our hospitals, but we didn't provide the treatment for the people once they're out of the hospitals. So you have literally hundreds of thousands of people now who are living in the community, many of them very successfully, but some not successfully, who 50 years ago would have been in the hospital. So the more you empty the hospital beds, and now there's only about 5% of the beds that were available 50 years ago, you're going to get problems if you don't provide treatment, and that's what we're doing.
Let's go to Brian in Durham, Connecticut. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I do pediatric emergency psychiatry at a large children's hospital here in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And every day in our emergency department, we see children, you know, as young as 6 years old, who come in from schools often. They're out of control. They're violent. They're threatening violent acts. We have teenagers who come in threatening to blow up schools. We have kids 12 years old who bring weapons to school.
So what do you do?
We evaluate them in the emergency department. We determine if they need psychiatric hospitalization or not. And if they do, we admit them. And then those kids are admitted to a hospital for a short time, usually a week to 2 weeks, if that. And then they're discharged out into the community.
What's the follow-up? What's the follow-up, Brian?
That's the problem. There's very little follow-up. It's very, very difficult to access appropriate treatment for these kids who will one day be 20 years old and be out there in society. And this is the thing that scares me the most. Not only do we can't access treatment for them, but we have no way to report these kids to anybody that they could be a threat now and in the future. If I have a 15-year-old come to my emergency department who's threatening to kill people at their school, we can hospitalize them, but then 2 years later, that kid, or 3 years later, they can go get a gun. They can go purchase a gun at Walmart. And there's no way that we have an ability to report that to anybody.
Pete Ehrlich, what are you thinking as you hear this story from someone who sees it every day right here in Connecticut?
Well, I'm torn. I'm torn because you can have a juvenile who is acting out. Do you want to stigmatize him for the rest of his life?
No.
Because of something that might have happened and mental illnesses are very, very hard to detect. You know, and children change. So I understand what he's saying, and I've seen it.
But neither do we want that child with a gun in hand a couple of years later, a danger to himself, herself, and others.
That's right. But I think one of the things that I liked about what the caller said is what I found out. Look, everybody just told me, get your kid involuntarily committed. If you can get him locked up, then they can fix him. Well, you know, getting involuntary commitment really is very, very tough on a family because you're the bad guy. But then when you get it done, the average length of stay in a hospital, if you can find a bed, and in Virginia, it took 4 hours to find a bed for my son. If you can find a bed, the average length of stay is 5 days. The medicine my son's on takes 5 weeks to even hit its therapeutic level. So what you do is you return with a child who is angry at you for doing this to you, angry because he's forced to take medication, and is probably more prone to be, you know, violent than when you went into the system. That's what's part of the danger.
But if something is really amiss, as you emphatically say, something needs to happen.
Yeah, and listen to what Connecticut has some fabulous services, but did you hear what she was saying many of those are? Jail diversion? mental health courts. In other words, we're failing. We're putting them in the criminal justice system. If you don't have good community service, if you don't, as Tom, you just pointed out, if you don't have services follow-up, if you can't make sure that that person, after he leaves the hospital, gets the kind of care, attention, and needs his needs met, then you are just simply putting a Band-Aid on it and waiting for it to get ripped off.
Dr. Ifolatori, I'll bring that Connecticut psychiatric nurse's observations to you as well. But first, Karen in Omaha, Nebraska. Karen, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. I wanted to thank you for having this conversation because this is such an important issue, and there isn't going to be one solution. And that's what I think is so difficult sometimes, because people want to be able to say we can do one thing or another thing, and if we do that, that will handle a certain percentage of it. But in my own experience, in my family, we adopted a boy through the state, not the state of Nebraska. This is where I live now, but when I was growing up, the state I lived in. Mm-hmm. And he was mentally ill. We did not know it at the time, but he was exhibiting behaviors. He was starting fires. He hung the dog. He choked some children at school. We moved him in and out of schools. We had him in therapy. We had him in several inpatient stays. When he was about 18, the final diagnosis, after a pretty lengthy stay at that time in the hospital, at which we had to pull quite a few strings to get back to the idea about beds and waiting times and things like that, was that he has antisocial disorder. And the previous diagnosis had been something along the lines of bipolar or personality disorder.
So what's the treatment, Karen? How have you dealt with this?
Well, that's an interesting question. He cannot be forced to have treatment. As a consequence, he has had violent escalating acts. He has been in and out of prison. He's been homeless. He found his biological sister, and he raped her. He's out for that now. He's been paroled. When he is in either psychiatric care or in a jail term for one of his stays in different states now, he receives treatment and he's in, you know, he's medicated. But there is no way to force medication compliance when he is not in prison. And that's pretty sad that throughout his childhood we were actively seeking care. And as an adult, he slips through the cracks, and the only way to get him help is when he does something violent.
Karen, I appreciate your call. I mean, we can just feel what it must be like. Here's your adopted son, and what do you do? Dr. Fuller-Torrey, Karen can't be the only one who has had this feeling of kind of helplessness in the face of a very tough reality.
There are dozens and dozens of families out there like Karen's family, and Brian also describes the problem very well, Tom. You have a small group of people who have proven dangerousness and who will only remain non-dangerous if they're on medication. In Brian's case in Connecticut, there is no provision, as the commissioner said, for what we call assisted outpatient treatment. So there's no provision for keeping people on medication in the community. And despite what she says about the laws, we look at all the laws in the Treatment Advocacy Center. The laws in Connecticut are among the most restrictive and most difficult to get treatment for the people who really need it best.
But she, I mean, she's not here to make her case, but I've seen it made that this is a view of how mental illness should be treated that doesn't apologize. It said this is the better way.
Well, in terms of people who don't know they're sick, we currently are letting everyone wander around in the community like that, and so we're having consequences of violent behavior, including these mass killings. If we want to protect everyone's civil rights to the nth, then that's what we're going to have to face. I would argue that there are people who are dangerous, who are proven dangerous. They need to be on medication. And if we don't medicate them, then we're going to have to suffer the consequences.
Let's talk about the bigger picture here, Dr. Fuller-Torrey. I mean, what about the context for these people, our entire cultural context, the amount of violence that we are exposed to visually in the media, even more than visually, kind of engaged with? People look at games. And cinema and all the rest, our family structures. I mean, how much of this is straightforward, if that word ever really applies, traditional mental illness or health as we've understood it? And then there's the abundance of guns all around. How much is the factors around? Look, all of us have the capacity to become, you know, to sort of fall off the straight and narrow one way or another. How much is cultural here?
Well, all of that, of course, makes things worse. But the bottom line is, if you have people with severe brain diseases and don't know they're sick and are having very psychotic thinking on it, the cultural thing is not as important as making sure these people get treatment.
You know, this has come up a lot just in these days since the killings in Newtown. Are you concerned that there may be some political element here, a political drive to turn the focus to mental health instead of the other issues, very much including the prevalence of guns in our society?
Tom, in our culture, in our country, the political is always there, and of course that's part of it. And we have to pay attention to the guns. And the guns are getting a good amount of publicity, I think, on this. And most of us, I think, who are thoughtful about these issues would say that there is good reasons to have more gun control. But gun control by itself is not going to solve the problem, because people who are severely mentally ill and want to become violent will use other weapons.
Peter Early, you've got this in the family. I'm going to give you the last word. Where would you like to see our emphasis, our attention in these days when the whole country is trying to think these issues through?
Well, I think it's important to remember that, yes, we're talking about severely mentally ill people, a small subset, but people like my son do and can get better. The trick is you got to look beyond just the traditional sticking a pill in a mouth for some of these people. Housing first, assertive community action teams. You got to realize it's a community problem, falls housing, jobs, veterans, all of these things can help someone move on with their life. My son's been stable for 6 years because he finally got the services he needed.
That is a relief to hear. Pete Early is author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Pete, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dr. E. Fuller Torrey at the Stanley Medical Research Institute, executive director there. Thank you very much, doctor.
My pleasure, Tom.
Tomorrow, we will look in this hour at the political power of the NRA after Newtown, asking, is it cracking? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.